from the 1980s right through into the 1990s as a nurse specialist, as a, what's called a clinical nurse specialist. You have those in America, don't you? That's, you know, I had this really straightforward career until I hit on this idea of doing a PhD in this whole area, and I started looking at it very critically, and my PhD destroyed my clinical career. Not because people turned against me or anything like that, but because I started looking at what I'd been involved in through very critical eyes. And I went into the labs, I looked at how the tests were run, I looked at what was behind the tests, and, you know, it just started undoing in front of my eyes, really, my whole, you know, the whole edifice that I'd been involved in. And I could never work in it after then again. I couldn't work in it. So I moved, as an academic by that time, so I was able to sidestep the whole field and work in other areas, other research areas. And that's how I got involved with all this right from the 90s.
From Chiron Return and for the Pacific Network, welcome to Planet Waves FM. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, your host for the next hour or so. Tonight's edition is for Friday, the 4th of December, 2020. Welcome to our program, wherever you may be, in the world, in the future, or in your state of mind. It's good to be with you. I'll be back in a moment. Once again, thank you for joining me on this Friday evening here in the hills of upstate New York, in this very unusual time in the history of the world. The opener to the program prior to the theme music starting was part of my interview with Dr. Kevin Corbett. Dr. Corbett is one of the 22 authors of a peer review paper that came out over the weekend on Saturday, this past Saturday. What was it, really 7 days ago? I forget the date. It was a Saturday right after Thanksgiving. And what this review, peer review by 22 European and British scientists, strives to do is to critique the scientific basis of a paper of which the principal author was a man named Christian Drosten, who is a German biologist, a German microbiologist, who is essentially the inventor of the protocols of the polymerase chain reaction test that is being used throughout the world to assess the case count and the cause of death in people who are said to have died of SARS-CoV-2 or 2019 nCoV. I have interviewed Dr. Corbett for 1 hour and 50 minutes, and I am placing that in a player below this one. So I'm going to do a shorter program tonight, and then you can hear the interview with Dr. Corbett as a standalone without interruption. What you heard was actually a little piece of our preface to the interview, where he was explaining his experience first as a clinical nurse handling AIDS patients for many, many years. So he begins with a specialty in nursing that involves patients with immune failure that was said to be caused by HIV. And as you heard him say at a certain point in his career, he chose to get involved in both the science of the HIV testing. There were a number of different tests, or still are, the ELISA test, the Western blot test, PCR test, and a number of others. And the social impact of testing for HIV. Any of you, any of us who have ever taken an HIV test understand something about that, how you might feel in the, you know, days before your test comes back. And what Dr. Corbett did was first he probed into the mechanics of the testing, the actual biological science of the testing, the enzymes, the assay that is used to count particles and so forth. And then that spread into a kind of a social sciences review of the impact of the testing. Dr. Corbett was one of the 22 signatories on what is being called the Drosten-Corbett review, an independent peer review of the Drosten-Corbett or Corbett-Drosten report. Hold on, I'm going to cue that up. I just restarted my computer, and I actually don't have that right in front of me. So let's get there. And I will just take another moment and hopefully pique your interest in this interview. And then in the I'm going to soon go into the astrology of our moment, this very unusual astrology of the moment that we are in as we approach the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in the first degree of Aquarius. And then I'm going to do one of my preview discussions to prep you on some of the technical and overall summary issues in this external peer review. So the proper name is the Corman-Drosten Review Report, curated by an international consortium of scientists in the life sciences. So it includes biochemists, medical doctors, and a diversity of other people who have signed on. It's a proper peer review. In fact, 22 signatories on a peer review is a very unusual number of reviewers. Usually there might be two or three or four reviewers who check the paper and make sure it's okay. One of Kevin Corbett's responsibilities in the role that he is in is to be a peer reviewer of the work of other scientists. We hear the words peer-reviewed journal, double-blind peer-reviewed journal. Well, one of the duties of academics is to participate in peer review, and he, like almost everyone else on the list of signatories, which you can see above the player, is involved in this in some respect, and they have certainly gotten involved now in publishing this external peer review of the polymerase chain reaction test. It's not really a test, actually, and I'm trying to train myself out of calling it a test and also out of saying that there are positive results, negative results, and false and positives and false negatives, because it is not a test. It does not produce results that have the capacity to diagnose anything. And this has been known for many, many years. As you will hear from Kevin Corbett, going back to the 1990s, you're also familiar with my references to the work of Celia Farber, who, as a young woman, took a job working for Spin magazine and was one of the first people to break the HIV/AIDS story in the 1990s. Okay, so, and when I say the HIV/AIDS story, I mean something like what we're about to learn about tonight. Okay, so that's by way of the short introduction. I just want to say also before I get going on the astrology that right now I'm not at my best tonight. It's been a very long and very difficult day. I did not sleep. There's some movement a bit behind the scenes in my world that I don't want to get into tonight. I will probably talk about it in more detail next week. Of course, I had the option to not do the program But I am one of these, the show must go on people, and I'm also someone who finds that in times of trial and tribulation, that to stay focused on my work is the thing that, that keeps my rudder in the water and my sails in the air, and just keeps me going forward. So you may hear me stumble over my words a bit more than usual tonight, and I am going to do my best, and I am very happy to be back here with you. All right, so astrologically, we are in this moment of the ages. Now, I've been writing mundane astrology and news astrology now for about 24 years. I started doing this type of work in 1996. That is to say, the astrology of the world and the astrology of the events of the world in astrology, we call that mundane astrology. And I've never, not only have I never seen anything like what we are going through today, but I have only encountered anything on this scale in some of the best science fiction that I have ever read. The book Hyperion, I forget the author's name, Daniel something, but it was one of the most moving science fiction books I ever read. That comes close to describing our moment. And of course, the fantasy novel The Lord of the Rings comes close to describing our moment. And one of the things we know about The Lord of the Rings is that for the most part, the action in The Lord of the Rings takes place behind the scenes of what is going on in public. And I reckon that it wasn't until history was finally recorded that the public, you know, meaning all the hobbits, had any clue of what had happened in the previous year. And in a similar way, most people right now are distracted by what is being called a pandemic. They're being distracted by this, what is essentially, whether or not you accept the definition of a pandemic as something that is happening, whatever your belief around this may be, whether you are right or whether you are wrong, there are many, many, many things that are going on behind the scenes that have nothing directly to do with the fact that there are some people who are ill in our society. And what the astrology is illustrative of is that there is a lot going on behind the scenes. And the way that appears in the astrology is what I would call a 12th house effect. The 12th house effect is things going on in the sign before the sign where the action is going to be, in the house before the one where the action is going to be. And so the 12th house is the house that precedes the first house. So that's why I'm calling it a 12th house effect. And so what goes on in the 12th house tends to be obscured by a fog, or by what you might call the fog of normal waking consciousness, where nothing unusual can get through, or as some describe the 12th house, the house of denial, delusion, and disconnect from reality. And the 12th house effect moves through the wheel. So you see a 12th house effect, for example, when you're looking at the affairs of the 4th house and there's activity in the 3rd house. You see a 12th house effect when you're looking at the affairs of the 10th house, but there's a lot of activity in the 9th. So when I say 12th house effect, and most astrologers would know what I mean, it is the sign or the house before. And the way that looks in terms of the astrology that we are living through right now is that the main event now, the main remaining event, aside from a total eclipse of the sun coming up in about a week and a half, after the lunar eclipse that took place on Monday in Gemini, we're having a total eclipse of the sun. Usually the eclipses come in pairs. They do little dances sometimes when they come in little groups of three, or you know, there's something is skipped here and there and things like that. But for now, we're on a somewhat normal pattern of having had a lunar eclipse about 4 days ago, and a total eclipse of the sun coming up in about 10 days on the 14th of December. So that's one thing running in the background. But by the 12th house effect that I'm talking about, again, if you don't mind me jumping around a little bit here, is that there is a lot of activity in Capricorn right now. And there is activity in Capricorn ahead of a major conjunction in Aquarius. So when I say a major conjunction, I mean, first of all, the last major conjunction of a year that has now had four so far, and a fifth one about to happen. The first was on the 12th of January, right around when Christian Drosten sent out his fraudulent codes for the polymerase chain reaction to the world, which became the World Health Organization's codes, adopted without peer review. And he unofficially circulated them at the time of the Saturn-Pluto conjunction. That itself being an approximately 32-year conjunction, the last one having happened in Libra in 82, but the conjunction in Capricorn hasn't happened since I believe in 1518 in the early 16th century. Spencer Stevens has done a magnificent article about this. That appears on the front page of planetwaves.net. You have to scroll down a little bit to get to that. What happened at the last Pluto-Saturn conjunction in Capricorn? And so this is an extraordinarily rare event. Saturn-Pluto in January, followed by three Jupiter-Pluto conjunctions. And now, as we anticipate, on the winter solstice, Northern Hemisphere winter solstice, the conjunction of the two largest planets. You can go out and look up in the sky, and you can see this. It is the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. Planets that, if I'm not mistaken, are about 2,200 times the size of the Earth, and I always forget the mass since they're a bit gaseous on the outside anyway. It's somewhere around, I'm going to estimate, around 800 or 900 times the mass of the Earth, as in the weight, the net weight, basically. And so this isn't called the Great Conjunction, right? This is what it's called, and it happens every 20 years. And so we had a 37-year event in the beginning of the year. We had three 13-year events, which are really one, because Jupiter was retrograde. And now we're having a 20-year event at the end of the year. And it is very unusual to have these happen at once. And when we look at Saturn-Pluto, that has not happened since the early 16th century. When we look at Jupiter-Saturn, the one coming up on the 21st, it has not happened in Aquarius since 1405. And so this is all enough to say to any astrologer that we're going to have a very unusual year. Now, I tend to soft sell astrology. When I am doing my year ahead type of things, or writing articles about the, you know, incredible aspects, part of my ethic as an astrologer and as a journalist is to underplay things a bit, to not hype things. I know that much of the astrology community hypes these things and, you know, makes lots of predictions about them. And I have chosen a different path as a writer, and an astrologer and teacher. I don't do that. And so, it wasn't that I missed all of this, but it was that, first of all, I don't overhype things, but second, I could never have foreseen, what was happening this year. And many, many people were blindsided. An epical transformation in the world that has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that some people are said to be getting sick from a virus. It is now plainly obvious that it is about much, much more than that. Okay, so in these weeks leading up to the Northern winter solstice on December 21st, Jupiter and Saturn and Pallas Athene, but Jupiter and Saturn, the big players, are moving through the last degrees of Capricorn. And they're doing so fairly slowly. They're not very fast-moving planets. They are doing so together. They are doing so after an astounding year of astrology already in Capricorn. And finally, they are doing so at the time of the United States-Pluto return. The United States is now approaching its Pluto return. I mean, it is obviously that we are in it. All of this stuff going on, all of this demolition of society and financial systems crashing, which goes back to 2008 when Pluto first dipped its little toe into Capricorn and there was a global financial market crash slash failure slash the second half of 9/11 of a financial crash. Remember this? A financial crash that was supposed to have been caused by bad mortgages. The film The Big Short is practically a documentary about this. The Big Short. The short meaning short selling, which basically means gambling on a future decline in the value of something. It is an incredible film, and I suggest you watch it because most people don't understand the extent that it is possible to take fraud, how far you can go to take fraud. And we are now seeing something similar as Pluto is now approaching at full strength its return to its natal position in the chart for the Declaration of Independence. One of the things I said earlier in the year is that the COVID situation in the United States would go on and on, specifically because the U.S. is in its Pluto return, which now to me seems as if it indicates a yet another collapse of society. I mean, that's obvious. But this is now on a world scale, so it's not just about the United States Pluto return. But the United States has something about it that is very distinctive, and that is why the chart for the Declaration of Independence is a world horoscope, which is it was an uprising against corrupt monarchy. It was the attempt to create a form of government that would not be this arbitrary, cruel, horrifying, absolutely arbitrary, hereditary form of government. And now the cycle of Pluto is coming full cycle. We're right ahead of Pluto's 248-year cycle, and we are seeing the full effects in the United States. This is associated with the world, but I think on the world scale, it's the Saturn-Pluto conjunction, which has nothing to do with any particular country chart. It's just a world transit, followed by the series of Jupiter-Pluto conjunctions, followed by this huge conjunction of the two most massive planets, essentially two complete solar systems. Jupiter and Saturn are both solar systems. I think between them they have about 80 moons. That's quite a pair of solar systems lining up in the first degree of Aquarius. And before that's happening, Jupiter and Pluto and Saturn are, and Pluto, but much more slowly, but this applies to Pluto as well, but especially to Jupiter and Saturn, are moving through these last degrees and that of Capricorn. And that is why it is a 12th house thing, because we're talking about an event that takes place in Aquarius, which would count in that as a, quote, first house or the reference house. And so there is all this incredible movement behind the scenes. And Capricorn, we know, is the sign of corporate structure, of government structure, and of the kind of accumulated residue of civilization and the buildup of traditions and institutions and the pillars of society and the church, which is really kind of halfway between Sagittarius and Capricorn. But in reality, the church is much more of a Capricorn institution because there's not all that much God in the church. It's more of an institution for its own sake, and it pretty much already has been, though I think Simon Peter would be astounded. Simon Peter, the man to whom Jesus said, "Upon this rock I build my church," according to the Testaments, would be astonished to see where the church had gone. In any case, this out of control, this thing spinning out of control effect that we are experiencing now, is illustrated, described by these two massive planets first approaching a conjunction. A cycle is ending. A cycle that, by the way, began in 2000. Second, it is happening in the last 2 degrees of Capricorn. And so when you're reading astrology, you see that these aneretic degrees, these degrees at the end of a sign, have very strange properties things that are just impossible to predict. Unusual things happening, seemingly impossible or miraculous things happening. Things happening out of control. Things going completely out of bounds. And that is what we are seeing happen right now as Jupiter and Saturn approach a conjunction that comes into partile within 1 degree. That's just sounds like a fancy word, but it really means in the same degree. And the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction occurs in the same degree, in the last degree of Capricorn first, and then it slides in a period of 48 hours into the first degree of Aquarius. So it is, in a sense, a double, because we get this aneretic impact in Capricorn, this edgy, on the edge, kind of like right after the end, but right before the beginning effect at the end of Capricorn, right ahead of the conjunction completing and perfecting in the first degree of Aquarius. And I am reluctant to be too optimistic about this, but I want to be optimistic about it. I have good reasons to not be optimistic, which is that I would like more people to be hip to what is going on and doing less accusing people of killing grandma and like take a step back and look at what is actually going on in the world. I am also deeply concerned about the destabilizing effect that the immersion in digital consciousness has had for the past 20 years, essentially since the last Jupiter-Saturn conjunction. The age of the internet, really the age of the public internet, sure, it begins in the 1990s, but the great conjunction of 2000, we are fully into the age of digital at that point. It is obvious that there is no turning back. There was, by the way, a financial crash in May of 2000, just after this conjunction, right, concurrent with the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction in Taurus, was the dot-com crash, where there was basically the bottom fell out of internet stocks. No one knew how any of these companies would make money. Far be it for anyone at that time to think that they would, in effect, own the world 20 years later. Who could have seen that? Amazon was still a bookstore at that point. Apple was still a little company making, okay, not so bad computers that had a lot of problems, and Jobs was not with the company at that time, as far as I recall. And no one knew how you were going to make money on the internet at that point. And what it turned out was, well, the way to make money on the internet is to basically control everything. Right? You weren't going to make the money selling website domains or server host or, you know, this kind of thing. Ultimately, the money had to be made by taking over, completely taking over. Nobody would have thought that a guy who split off from PayPal, Elon Musk, would be building rocket ships and planning a colony on the moon. Did you? Would you have said that? If I had said, you know, Google too is in the rocket ship business. If I had said this little search engine that was a joke, when I saw Google, the first iteration of Google in 1998, I laughed. You can't even find the logo that they had on the website. It was like in black and white, G-O-O-O-O-O-O-O-O-G-L-E. I remember seeing the first time I saw it, and I thought, wow, there were a lot of horseshit dog engines at that time, like Dogpile and, you know, all this stuff. Who would have thought that these companies would take over the world? That's what's happened in this 20-year cycle. In this 20-year Jupiter-Saturn cycle. And we are at the end of the cycle where it's really edgy and really intense, and you just don't know what's going to come next. And you can see, though, that what astrology gives us is the ability to see, that's why astrology thinks it can predict things, that you can see a conjunction happens in the first degree of Aquarius, not on any day of the year, on the Capricorn solstice, arguably, well, no doubt one of the most powerful days of the year, but the shortest day. In the north, there's a time compression factor. The effect is the same in the south. There's this stretched out feeling at the summer solstice, right, where things like, you ever have that feeling at the summer solstice where you're wondering, God, is it ever going to get dark out? Bring on the night. And at the winter solstice, it's like everything is compressed and happening fast. And in many years of covering news astrology, day by day and hour by hour, I have seen every year at this time of year that there is just complete political lunacy going on. I've tried to explain it a number of times, and we are now seeing it on a level that I just am dumbstruck by every single day. And we'll get into that in the next segment. So what occurs over the next few weeks is that the three major events are, and we could design a lot of approaches to show somewhat subordinate events, a little less important, but the three major events are the total eclipse of the sun on the 14th of December. This is an acceleration device. Eclipses are what I describe as having the Venturi effect. Now, every car's got fuel injection. I bet there's even mechanics who've heard of Venturis but don't know what they are. A Venturi is a thing that is in a carburetor. A carburetor is the old device that used to be in engines that would volatilize the gasoline so that it could explode in the piston. And the way you volatilize it is you run it through a bottleneck. And in the course of running through the bottleneck, there is an acceleration of the speed of the air because there's pressure on the air. And so the narrower the Venturi gets, it's like a kind of a gently sloping funnel, with a little more curve than the normal triangle funnel that we're used to, as the air goes through the narrower portion of the funnel, it accelerates, and this volatilizes the fuel. It heats the fuel up, and then it's injected into the pistons and blows up and propels the engine forward. And so eclipses have always reminded me of what's called the Venturi effect, this acceleration, volatilization, a point of no return, bang. So eclipses have that quality. So the first thing that happens on the next major event is in 10 days. Total eclipse of the sun at 24, that is to say 23 and change of Sagittarius. That is then followed 2 days later by Saturn, 2-3 days later by Saturn re-entering Aquarius to stay. That is then followed by Jupiter entering Aquarius for the first time in about 12 years. And then that is then followed by the winter solstice. And then right upon the winter solstice, Jupiter and Saturn make their exact alignment 30 degrees away right at that very compressed moment. And so this is a series of acceleration effects. It's a series of what you might think of as Venturi effects. They sometimes remind me of gravity assist boosts or the slingshot effect, as the energy is just going to pick up momentum and is likely to seem more and more and more chaotic. And I want to point out something here before we go into the second portion of the program, is that this chaos, all of what is happening in the world, all of the political actions, all of the lockdowns, all of the social distancing, all of the masking, all of what verges on full-on martial law in a way that nobody really, unless you're like, you know, into that stuff as like your hobby, would imagine happening in the United States of America or indeed throughout the world simultaneously, all of it, all of the fear is based on one thing. A thing called the PCR test. Without the PCR test, which is not a test, there would be nothing except potentially some sick people, which happens every year. Every year, there have been massive flus, what they call the flu. One of the things I learned, well, we'll get into that in the next section, is normal. It's normal for the hospitals to fill up at this time of year. It's normal for surge capacity to be consumed at this time of year. What is not normal is this utter and complete pandemic of panic based on this new thing rolled out to the general public, being used in every city and town laboratory, basically in the world, called the polymerase chain reaction device, invented by a very sweet guy named Cary Mullis in 1983. It would not be happening. There would be something else happening, but what's happening now would not be happening. There would be no way to justify this absolutely extravagant, insane response without being able to say, as the New York Times said today, that 216,548 people count as new cases. This is a very important word, cases, because it implies a diagnostic and diagnosis. And so the many have read Rick Tarnas, you know, the Cosmos and Psyche, wherein he describes that plagues happen at the time of Saturn-Pluto events, right? Except that without that, without the polymerase chain reaction, this wouldn't be considered a global pandemic worthy of a complete reset of the world. It would just be considered a normal bad flu season. And that is unusual. That is different. And so everything hinges on this device. What also hinges on the device is the death count. Now, dead is dead, except that when you get into ascribing the cause of death as all being from one thing, right? That's the concept of the death count, right? Is it's all from one thing. That one thing has only one means of diagnosis, quote unquote diagnosis, and that is the polymerase chain reaction. And that is what I'm going to introduce in reintroduce to you in the next section in the form of the Corman-Drosten review. I'm going to give you some other backstory that is frankly completely phenomenal in the process of that, and this is all by way of preparing you to listen to my discussion with Kevin Corbett. Okay, let's go to some music. I have chosen tonight, since I've been watching a lot of Twin Peaks season 3. Which I think is one of the great works of cinema ever. I'm not sure if you're a Twin Peaks fan, but I will tell you, if you like really well done cinema, it is worth and enjoyable watching the first two seasons of Twin Peaks so you can know what you're looking at in season 3, which came out 25 years later. after the first two. Very unusual thing, right? To have season one in like 1992, season three the next year, maybe I'm off by a year, and then season three in 2017, right? This is with a lot of the same actors. And the action having moved 25 years ahead. So I have been taking great pleasure in watching season three. I know I've got a couple of listeners who really dig this. My friend Juan in France and others get the metaphor of the Black Lodge, this parallel dimension where much on Earth is being run from this parallel dimension called the Black Lodge. Here we are. So this band though is called Silencio, and it is I'm not that good at the other Lynch films. I've seen a bunch of them, but it's this one scene in a David Lynch film. I forget which one it is. But, you know, there's this really weird nightclub scene where there's like an MC and a performer and just two people in the room. These just two women who become lovers by strange circumstances, and the MC says, "Silencio." So this is where Silencio, the band, takes its name, and they are a tribute band to the music of Angelo Badalamenti, who is the composer of music in all David Lynch films, except maybe Eraserhead. Maybe he hadn't met him back when he was a student. And so a absolutely incredible tribute band formed. And you think, a tribute band? Well, so I sat at the feet of these guys. That's how I met them and how I know about this music. In 2013, this incredible year in my life for alternative music, the best year since the new wave movement was going on, and my dear friend Michael Ackerman would take me out to the city to see people like Joe Jackson and Squeeze and the Specials and the Jam and all this other incredible stuff. And the next amazing year was all the way out in 2013, and I met Silencio, and I sat there at the edge of the stage, stunned at the not only the beauty of the music, but watching this band work, watching how absolutely tight they were, and playing to perfection. Hope you agree. This piece is called Music for Crows.
Thank you.
Yeah. On Planet Waves FM Pacifica, Silencio, music for crows. All right. So I'm going to see if I can dial it back a little bit and proceed in more of my late night laid back style. It's only 7 o'clock here, but given the fact that it's around the solstice time, it has that feeling of like, is it really the time it says on the clock, or is it like 9:30 at night or midnight or something like that? Let's say, summary of the first 40 minutes of the program is, if you're feeling a little edgy, you're not going crazy. So all you can do is your best, but then I think we can always even do a little bit better than our best and stretch sometimes. So I know people are working, many are working with limited resources, and you know, there may seem to be a lot of days where the wheels are coming off, and you wonder how it is that you're going to get through the day. Over the Thanksgiving weekend was one of the unquestionably the most astounding weekend concentrated phase of events I have ever witnessed as a journalist. Journalism involves a lot of observation, a lot of getting in there and reporting, a lot of taking months or years to figuring things out, particularly the kind that I do. I don't do the kind of journalism where you're an expert on the circus the day the circus is in town, and then you're doing a feature on brake repair, and then the day after that you're doing a thing for the Sunday magazine on like the newest brand of bubbles. I'm more the long-form investigative reporter, and stories kind of have a life of their own in a way, and they have peaks and valleys, and they build up, and at the beginning it can seem it has felt to me like I was expected to scale a brick wall. You know, that's like impossible. How am I going to do this? But I'm in front of this thing that I have to somehow get to the other side of. And as I may have said on different occasions, I don't choose my stories. My stories choose me, and COVID is one of them. So in the weekend after the Thanksgiving holiday and immediately before the eclipse of the moon in Gemini, three major developments happened in the COVID story. And I want to just slightly preface this by saying that anyone who questions the narrative that a bat met a pangolin in China and then the world shut down, which is what we're expected to believe, that's the official story. A bat... No, they don't even know it was a pangolin. They say maybe it was a pangolin. A bat met some other animal at some unspecified time in some market that's never been tested. There were cases of pneumonia in China, and then boom, everything collapses essentially within 12 weeks. Anyone who questions that is said to be a conspiracy theorist and will be accused of killing grandma. If you question COVID narrative, meaning bat meets some other animal at some unknown time, causes a global outbreak of something, you are very likely to be accused of killing people and of being a conspiracy theorist. So keep that in mind. And keep in mind that the accusation of conspiracy theorist is always to discredit. However, when things are published by Johns Hopkins University, not only one of including one of the world's foremost medical centers, but directly involved in the planning of a thing, the staging of a thing called Event 201, which I have published a video of in my most recent article, part four of the video, literally a rehearsal drill for a coronavirus pandemic in early 2020, with the rehearsal happened in October of 2019. It was videotaped, it was planned to be this way, and what is so interesting is that the planning for the pandemic had nothing to do with taking care of sick people. This was not a mass casualty incident drill called an MCI drill. This was a lockdown, censorship, news reporting of imminent disaster, blocking people from Facebook, shutting down parts of the internet so that people couldn't spread disinformation, coronavirus pandemic drill type. Nothing to do with sick people. All to do with politics, markets, and so forth. And this was staged by Johns Hopkins, paid for by the Gates Foundation, Johns Hopkins Health Security Center. Here's the first news. On, let's see, what is the date on this study? November 22nd, a little over a week ago, Johns Hopkins, on its official newsletter, it's called Newsletter Stylized with a hyphen, the pillar of the medical and academic establishments, and one of the official voices of the COVID issue, said that there were no excess deaths in 2020. An analysis of CDC data by a master's candidate at Johns Hopkins, a master of applied economics, candidate for a master's degree in applied economics, did a review of available CDC data, which said, in the calculation, right, scientific papers are not an opinion. Science analysis is not an opinion. It is a thing that the facts point to. And they said there were no excess deaths in 2020, especially of old people. The study said, surprisingly, the deaths of older people stayed the same before and after COVID-19. Since COVID-19 mainly affects the elderly, experts expected an increase in the percentage of deaths in older age groups. However, this increase is not seen from the CDC data. In fact, the percentages of deaths among all age groups remain relatively the same, Johns Hopkins University published in its official, very high-profile newsletter. This is not the University of Michigan at Kalamazoo Nursing School. This is Johns Hopkins University, which staged Event 201. Quote, they go on. These data analyses suggested, in contrast to most people's assumptions, the number of deaths by COVID-19 is not alarming. In fact, it has relatively no effect on deaths in the United States. Now, we've seen other versions of this story. One of them is the infection fatality rate. There are studies which now indicate that the survival rate is 99.8%. If you're not in a care home, it is 99.9% of cases, quote unquote cases. We're going to find out why that is in a second. Under the age of I believe 65 or 75. And then it's bad 75, and it's then it's like higher if you're over 75, but still the overall infection fatality is 99.8%. Essentially, no different than the claims of the seasonal flu. Certainly not millions of dead people. And in this version of things that came out in early August, we learned that 94% had between 2 and 3, essentially terminal diseases. So we've seen this before. However, we haven't just seen a cold analysis that says the death rate has not increased. Now, you could say, well, what happened? Why does it seem like people are dying? I don't know. Well, I have a couple of theories, but I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure if it's even true. But that's the problem with science, and the purpose of science. The purpose of science is to end the illusion of what you think is true and show you what is actually true. That's the point of science. It's so that you're not just basing things on suppositions. For example, thinking a virus is causing something when it's really diarrhea medication, as was the case in a 14-year episode in Japan, ascribed over and over and over again since the 19... when did this take place? I don't quite remember. The book I read it in was published in the 90s. So this was going on up until then, so it has to have started in the 80s. All of the cases were caused by anti-amoeba diarrhea medication. And they thought, well, nurses and patients are getting it. It must be contagious. What happened was patients were taking the medicine and dying. And the nurses were taking it home and taking it and dying. So the purpose of science is to disillusion the illusion. And so when an advanced economics student with editorial review looks at the numbers and says, I don't see that. I don't see the claim. Well, that's something. The uproar was so huge that the administration tried to walk back the article. It was cast as, well, it wasn't exactly right. They didn't really know what they were talking. It wasn't inaccurate. They didn't really use the official line from the CDC, 280,000 deaths. The point was to question that, though, right? The point wasn't just to repeat it. And I am beyond astonished at the blizzard of disinformation coming from the mass media. The blizzard of disinformation and the utter failure of curiosity on all of these issues. Bat at a market? Huh? Repeatedly disproven. Numerous ways. The whole thing existed before the bat in the market. If anything existed at all, it predates the bat by 3 months. Okay. Anyway, so Johns Hopkins walks it back. And people are saying, well, the students didn't do a good job. Well, no, you're going to hear in an interview, hopefully next week, the story of when Celia Farber interviewed a scientist who was questioning the CDC, a guy named Peter Duesberg, and it came out in Spin magazine, this kind of gritty magazine competing with Rolling Stone in the 1990s. The big cheese at the NIH at that time, Robert Gallo, was personally on the phone screaming at Celia Farber, who I interviewed for a while on Saturday, demanding that she never do this again if she wanted a career in journalism, on and on and on and on. The big motherfucker at the NIH, the guy who's basically not quite in Fauci's position now, but he's sort of like the father of Fauci, another Italian dude, personally screaming at a writer, age 22. So you can be sure that when Johns Hopkins, the very name associated with the medical establishment in Maryland, it's right in the nation's capital, right next door, says there's not excess deaths, that's going to cause a big fucking fuss and the phone calls are going to fly. And the university walked it back. But what is even more astounding is that everyone just accepted the denial. Oopsie daisy. Oh, some student made a mistake. You forget that they were a master's student in applied economics and that many people worked on this and that it wasn't, nobody just wrote an email and pushed send. No investigation, no discussion, no news coverage, none. Just this absolutely incredible report and a walk back. So I got an email from someone who said, you sent me one of these like fact check things and said, you have to check your facts before you report them. And I said, it is not my job to make sure that the Johns Hopkins University newsletter is correct. And the work of this author, it is my job to report what is in the newsletter. And when the administration or whoever denies it, to report that they denied it. I'm not saying it happened. I'm saying they're saying it happened. That's what journalists are supposed to do. I'm supposed to say who says what based on these facts. Okay, now, it gets better. So remember that the idea there were no excess deaths is completely unacceptable to the point where that's it. Boom, vanished, never happened. Now, you're hearing about it, the few of the proud. Next, on November 20th, just 2 days ahead of this, the eminent British journal Nature, which was founded in 1869, we've all seen this, you know, when the New York Times says, according to Nature, you think, oh, wow, this is a proper peer-reviewed study. Published a new study of nearly 10 million people in one city declaring that there is no asymptomatic spread of the virus. That city would be Wuhan. It is not merely based on who tested positive, but rather who tested positive, got sick, and all the contact tracing of both the asymptomatic positives and the symptomatic positives. 10 million people studied. The data came in August. The publication was in November. So it was August, September, and October, and most of November that this paper was peer-reviewed. Now, if the basis of the entire pandemic is the polymerase chain reaction, the second basis is the concept of asymptomatic spread. So we've been told that the reason for the social distancing, the reason for the lockdown, the reason for the cancellation of the baseball season, and putting fake people in the stands, the reason for shutting down restaurants, the reason for leaving grandma alone in the nursing care facility on Thanksgiving, the reason for making little kids wear masks in schools, the reason for shutting down school districts, the reason for making a kid who's going to play soccer wear a mask outside when he's walking from the car to the soccer field, and then he can take the mask off when he's on the soccer field. The reason for all the masks all the time and all the distancing and all the shutdowns is asymptomatic spread. We don't know who's spreading this. Right? Is there any other reason? Because if it was just symptomatic spread, sick people should stay home. That's it. Just like for the previous eternity. But no asymptomatic spread. And this is not like a study in Galveston, Texas of like one town. This is a study of every single person, 9.5 million people in Wuhan, China. No asymptomatic spread. The study I wrote tested every single person in Wuhan where the outbreak is said to have begun. The notion of lockdowns, of distancing, of masking, of closing the economic and social life of entire societies is based solely on the notion of asymptomatic spread, which is in turn based on the polymerase chain reaction saying that you're positive. This has not been retracted or walked back or anything like that. How is it possible that you're hearing about this from me first unless you read Planet Waves? In which case, you heard about it from me first. Did you hear about this anywhere? My Facebook feed, maybe? Planet Waves, or right now. No asymptomatic spread of the virus. Wow, what's going on here? Well, I have some ideas. Third, and what we're going to start now and continue after a song break. Anyone who's listened to my program once or twice has heard me give my evolving, let's say, discourse on the polymerase chain reaction test, what it does, how it works, and the fact that going back to at the very latest, 2006, they knew that this device was capable of creating 100% false positives. So now, if you say that, you'll be accused of claiming that the pandemic is not real and therefore you're a nut job. Except that everyone knows about this incident, which I call the Dartmouth-Hitchcock incident in 2006, which was reported by the university, reported by a publication called MMWR, Coming out of CDC, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly reported a major feature on this incident, and then followed up by the New York Times, which got it right that time. And we, Spencer Stevens, put this whole thing together, found the incident, found the backup. He went to the MMWR. He went to the Dartmouth University official publication, and the story is consistent straight through. We know 142 false cases, which created a pseudo epidemic, which basically shut down the medical school. So we know about these problems, and I've been reporting problems with the polymerase chain reaction all year long, pointed to the issue by John Rappaport and Celia Farber and others, and then I've verified this all over and over again. So you can imagine that I was absolutely stunned when I clicked on my email and saw an email from Cindy Ragusa, the bloodhound of investigators, who the Lord, proof of the existence of God is that Cindy Ragusa is in my life. And her only comment was, here we go. And it was this report called the external peer review of the RT-PCR test to detect SARS-CoV-2 reveals 10 major scientific flaws at the molecular and methodological level, consequences of false positive results. Now, before the song break, how long are we looking at here? I've got about 3 or 4 minutes. I want to explain one important fact previous to all of this, which is that the notion that there was a novel virus that was causing a new disease, and therefore a global pandemic, was established in one scientific paper. The paper was, let me see if I can find the title of that. It's short. It's for shorthand called the Corman-Drosten paper. And it was published on January 23rd, though Drosten released his sequences at the time of the Saturn-Pluto conjunction, right ahead of the 12th. And so laboratories around the world had these sequences, could program them into the PCR, and essentially use these genetic sequences in the PCR, right? You tell it what to do. It's like a new computer. It has nothing on it. You've got to put your own book on it, your own photos, your own music, whatever. Well, PCR comes blank, and you tell it what to look for. And the thing you tell it to look for is known as a kind of a test kit. And the test kit is mainly, the most important thing in the test kit is a set of instructions to program the PCR. And the entire basis for that, which means the entire basis of the test, which is the entire basis of the case count, the notion that people are dying from something, the entire concept of COVID-19, the entire concept of the pandemic, the entire concept of the lockdowns, the shutdowns, the economic reset, the devastating pain that this has caused on people, is this one paper that establishes the test, that establishes the protocols for the test, that makes the claim of a novel virus, that they've done the work to establish that there is a novel virus. This is being held up by one pillar, Corman-Drosten paper, which had itself about 20 authors. You're going to hear, when you listen to the interview with Dr. Corbett, you're going to hear him talk about who some of these people are. And I read through this paper, and because I have spent 10 months studying the polymerase chain reaction and its history, and the journalists who've recorded, speaking with the journalists who've recorded its history, you can imagine my jaw was hanging. I couldn't believe it. It points out 10 major, they point out small errors in the beginning, and then they say, but now let's talk about the major errors. And there are 10 categories of major error, bad error, like terminal flaw and fraud, which we'll get to in a moment. Here is some more Silencio. This piece is called Harvest Companion. Silencio on Planet Waves FM. Yeah. All right. So with that as a preface, I will now break down the contents of this report and explain it as best I can. This is a thorough analysis of the whole thing. I quit my browser. Let's see. The whole Drosten-Korman report. And I have been on to the Drosten-Korman report paper for many, many, many months. And we found a paper by Korman from very early in the year that said, oh, well, you know, this test is likely to pick up all Asian viruses, quote, in a scientific paper. So he admits, the principal, one of the principal authors admits of the Korman-Drosten paper, admits that the test is overbroad. And we all know, anybody who's listening, who's not in complete denial, knows this test can pick up a previous cold, it can pick up previous flu, it can pick up some other coronavirus, of which there are many, and that it can pick up healthy, normal, human sequences. And it's being used to diagnose an imminent disease that's being used to change the world, shut down the world, leave grandma alone in the care home and let her deteriorate and die because we don't want to give her a disease. But the poor woman is completely supported by the fact that her family cares about her. All of this is based on the positive test result of the polymerase chain reaction. And when we look at this, here's what we find. I'm going to go over the major errors that this lists out, 10 categories. Let me read a couple of quotes from the concise review report, just because I like to read. It'll go in a little bit differently than if you were reading, but I'm reading from the report page, number of pages. I suggest you visit them all. One's the letter to a publication called Eurosurveillance, which published the Korman-Drosten paper on 123, went out around the world and led everyone to the incontrovertible conclusion that there was a novel virus causing a new disease. The authors write in the concise review report, "This paper will show numerous serious flaws in the Korman-Drosten paper, the significance of which has led to worldwide misdiagnosis of infections attributed to SARS-CoV-2. The associated disease COVID-19, which by the way does not exist in any legal sense. It's not a real thing. It's a concept, as is what you're about to hear. We are confronted with stringent lockdowns that have destroyed many people's lives and livelihood, limited access to education, and imposed restrictions by governments around the world that are a direct attack on people's basic rights and their personal freedoms, resulting in collateral damage for entire economies on a global scale. There are 10 fatal problems with the Korman-Drosten paper, which we will outline and explain in greater detail in the following sections. The first and major issue is that the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, in the publication named 2019 nCoV, its original name, and in February renamed SARS-CoV-2, is based on in silico or theoretical sequences supplied by a laboratory in China. Theoretical, we talked about this, right? A couple of weeks ago, I was talking about this. The lack of purified isolate, meaning they're using a hypothetical or what is got termed in science in silico, S-I-L-I-C-O, in silico, theoretical sequences supplied by a lab in China, because at the time neither control material or infectious live or inactivated SARS-CoV-2 nor isolated genomes of the RNA virus were available to the authors. To date, no validation has been performed by the authorship of that paper based on an isolated SARS-CoV-2 viruses or full length thereof." Let me break that down. the original PCR test, as are all subsequent ones, but the original one, the most important test in the history of mankind, the most important diagnostic scientific assay in the history of mankind, was based on theoretical sequences because there was no virus found. I know this from multiple sources, not in Canada, not isolated in Canada, not isolated in the United States, not isolated in England, and not isolated in China, therefore not isolated anywhere. And you will read reports that say it's isolated. They are not telling the truth. They're using a different definition of isolation of the virus. The definition that they're using is not true purification. It is saying you're a bank robber because you have a quarter in your pocket. That's the logic. That's what they're calling isolation. Well, we've proven you're a bank robber because we found a quarter in your pocket. Really? What's the logic of that? Well, there's quarters in banks. Therefore, everyone with a quarter in their pocket is a bank robber. That's what they mean by isolation and purification. Isolation in these papers that are faking it. True isolation means you've got a sample of it. You've got the bank robber and the money and the witnesses. You've got a purified, isolated sample. There is none. There never was any. They don't have the stuff. And I know it sounds a little over the top to say that the world is claiming millions of deaths for, I don't know what the claim is. There's a statistical model going on, Worldometer. Worldometer. Let's see what they're up to today. They're claiming 1.5 million deaths and 66 million cases based on a virus that no one has a sample of. Now, I am not saying they don't have a sample of it. CDC says they don't have a sample of it. The English equivalent says they don't have a sample of it. The Canadian Health Authority says they don't have a sample of it. China can't provide a sample of it. And now these scientists are saying flaw number one is your whole test is based on a theoretical sequence that does not exist in nature. The first major issue, let me read this again now that you kind of understand it. The first major issue is that the novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, previously known as 2019-nCoV, I'm reading right from the top, by an international consortium of virus experts, is based on in silico theoretical sequences supplied by a laboratory in China. Because at the time, neither control material, live or inactivated, SARS-CoV-2 had been isolated by genomic RNA analysis of the virus. To date, no validation has been performed. They don't have a check on their test. They have no way to validate whether their test is looking for the quote-unquote right thing, because nobody has any of the right thing. So that this when someone goes and gets snot taken out of their nose and they put it in the thing on the thing in the test tube and they put it in the polymerase chain reaction and they close the drawer and it starts to analyze it, they are looking in nature, meaning in snot, for a thing that doesn't exist in nature because it's an in silico sequence. It's a theoretical sequence. And this is the essence of the con game. It's finding all kinds of positives, but we know that it doesn't exist. The thing they're looking for is not a virus that exists. It's a couple of things we'll get to in a second called primers that are matching up with something in the sample, and that is said to be proof positive of infection. Even if they had the sequences right, it wouldn't be proof positive of infection because the presence of viral particles, assuming they're viral, is not proof of infection. It may be proof of having had a virus 5 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe absolutely nothing. Maybe you had a cold, maybe you're under stress, maybe you inhaled something, maybe it's normal human RNA. Okay, the PCR test was therefore designed using genomic sequences of SARS-CoV as control material for what's called the Serbeco component. We know this from personal email communication with one of the authors of the Corman-Drosten paper. this method to model SARS-CoV-2, a computer model. They made a computer model. I've seen an animation of this in the software used to make the model. It's like a beautiful thing they're saying is a virus, but it's data, as is the whole PCR. The establishment and validation of a diagnostic workflow for 2019 nCoV screening and specific confirmation, designed in absence of available virus isolates or original patient specimens. Design and validation were enabled by the close genetic relatedness to the 2003 SARS-CoV sequence and aided by the use of synthetic nucleic acid technology, Photoshop. No more real than a picture of me naked riding a tiger twirling flame. The reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction is an important biomolecular technology to rapidly detect rare RNA fragments, which are known in advance. You know what you're looking for. You've got some, and you say, that's what it is. We'll sequence it, and we'll have the machine look for more of that. But when you take something that is purely theoretical, you put it in the machine, and you find matches in nature, you are so far from a virus that it's like, you might as well jump over the Empire State Building. The technology is highly sensitive, and its detection limit is theoretically one molecule of DNA. The specificity of the PCR is highly influenced by biomolecular design errors. Okay, so the minor concerns are a bunch of things. They find like three minor errors, then 10 major concerns. Background. The authors introduce their scientific work as, quote, "the ongoing outbreak of a recently emerged novel coronavirus poses a challenge for public health laboratories as virus isolates are unavailable when there is growing evidence the outbreak is more widespread than initially thought, and international spread through travelers does already occur." So when you hear the word virus isolates, you hear that as actual virus. Okay? This is what I've spent my year doing. According to BBC and Google Statistics, there were 6 deaths worldwide on January 21st, 2020, a day when the manuscript was submitted and, by the way, approved in 24 hours. Why did the authors assume a challenge for public health laboratories when there was no substantial evidence at that time to indicate that the outbreak was more widespread than initially thought? Okay, 6 deaths worldwide on January 21st, 2020. 6. They submit the paper, and they're saying, this is going to be a huge issue. Here's some sequences. Go test them. It is an aim the authors declared to develop and deploy robust diagnostic methodology for use in public health laboratory settings without having virus material available. I'll read that again. As an aim, the authors declared to stop and deploy robust diagnostic methodology for use in public health laboratory settings, and even though that's a complete sentence, without having virus material available. So again and again, there are two sides of the same coin. There's no virus material available, meaning actual virus from patients that is then used to prime thing to find more of that thing that's supposedly making people sick. Instead, they're in, by every scientific account, by 4 different governments and this group of scientists, they're using a theoretical sequence and then finding that in people, and not only claiming that they're infected, but it's a confirmed case and therefore a disease. Further, they acknowledge the present study demonstrates an enormous response capacity achieved through coordination from academic and public laboratories in national and European research networks. Okay, so this is only the background. That's the background statement. Methods and results, primer and probe design. So this was the this for me was the big one, and I spent some time with Kevin Corbett understanding what this really means. But the primers are the thing that you put in to the machine to tell it what to look for, and what you're supposed to do is use several primers, search terms, as it were, for supposedly unique RNA sequences and spread them out for accuracy. You're supposed to spot check, but you're supposed to spot check in a wide range of areas. And what they did was they concentrated the primers in a very close range of the genetic sequence that they had, and therefore it's getting more positive results. So they concentrated the primers, and they're just going to find this stuff pretty much wherever they look. That's why they're saying there's 216,000 cases diagnosed yesterday. Now, so they describe this, and they go through. These are people who work on these machines, who do studies on these machines, who know what the heck they're talking about, and they describe the locations of the primers, the locations in the genetic code, and why they're too close together to get an accurate response. Okay, so this goes on and on and on. It's I'm not sure how many pages it comes out to be. Let's look a little bit more here, and I am getting a bit fatigued. Here's another error. Okay, this is getting into terms I can't explain to you. I'm not gonna read them out loud. More important visual test reactions are they negative upon retesting with the same assay. Four individual test retractions. In four individual test retractions, weak initial reactivity was seen. However, they were negative upon retesting with the same assay. So they're running sample tests to see. They get a weak positive in the first case. They call it a positive, and then they retest and they get a negative. This we hear about. Elon Musk, market room, eBay guy who wants to go to Mars. That day he got two negatives and two positives. Same nurse, same nose, same dude, same day, same machine. Two negatives and two positives. Helpful, right? Way to prove it. These signals were not associated with any particular virus. For each virus with which initial positive reactivity occurred, there were other samples that contained the same virus at higher concentration but did not test positive. So what they're saying is they took some of that same stuff and they ran it through the thing, and it was supposed to find it, and it didn't. That's called a positive control. So they've got problems with their positive controls and their negative controls. This stuff is supposed to be science, right? You're supposed to know you've got a clean machine, a clean lab. You're supposed to know that you can hit what you're aiming for, and that you're aiming for what you know is making people sick. All of this fails. When you look at the details, it all fails. Given the results, the writers continue, given the results from extensive technical qualification described above, it was concluded this initial reactivity was not due to chemical instability of the PCR probes and most likely handling issues of the rapid introduction of new diagnostic tests and controls during the evaluation study. Oh, they were just rushing. Okay, let me turn off the approaching song break so I'm not startled while I'm reading to you. Okay. Let's see. Basically, this just goes on and on and on and on. In a couple of concluding points, the Corman-Drosten test was not designed to detect the full-length virus, but only a fragment of the virus. We already concluded that this classifies the test as unsuitable as a diagnostic test for SARS virus infections, close quote. Not only do they say this, the manufacturers say this, the FDA says this, the CDC says this, everyone knows that finding fragments of some RNA in someone's nose does not mean that they have a disease. Everyone has a molecule of cancer cell in their body. Doesn't mean you have cancer or ever will. So this is just astonishing. And then furthermore, the paper is approved in just 24 hours. It's submitted, approved, and published in just 24 hours. That is not enough time to review anything, to check the validity of the data, for anyone to run the test themselves. It was just whoosh, right through, done, released to the world based on theoretical computer code. So I want to make this clear. Without respect to anything else, the PCR test is programmed with theoretical computer code, not real sequences from real viruses. It is therefore looking for something that does not exist in nature and therefore cannot be making anyone sick. No. Nature has shown there's no asymptomatic spread. Johns Hopkins has said that there are no excess deaths, though they retreated on that. Many other studies are saying the overall fatality rate is 2 people in 1,000 of infected people. Well, that makes perfect sense now, because this test is doing nothing except blowing confetti up in the air and saying this is a global pandemic. Because they can find it anywhere. You can find a quarter in the pocket or purse of nearly anyone. But you can't conclude that they're bank robbers based on finding a quarter in their pocket, and that's what this is doing. And not only that you're a bank robber, that you're a bank robber who's going to make other people into bank robbers, all because you've got a quarter in your pocket, and there's quarters in banks. That's how insane this is. Now, we talk about, Kevin and I talk about whether and why people are getting sick. We covered this point. I have covered this point in an article called What I Think is Happening. If I given strength, I will link to that tonight. I'm almost done. All my song breaks are in place, and the webpage is done, and it's only 8 o'clock. I'm running ahead of schedule after being delayed by 3 to 4 hours today. Among everything else. Okay, so without respect to what may or may not be making anyone sick, which is a separate matter, including who it is, who they are, what illnesses they have, and what actually caused their sickness and their death, without respect to any of that, it is simply not in the realm of reality to claim that a person has 2019 SARS-CoV-2 because that does not exist. It has never been isolated and purified. That's what exist means, right? What does it mean to have baked a cake? Well, you have a cake that you baked. It is there. I'm holding a aircraft aluminum pencil. It exists because it's right there. I can weigh it. I can look at it. I can smell it. It smells like aluminum. Oh, that's interesting. It feels like it's a nice solid pencil. It's my standard issue pencil. It exists. Why do we know it exists? Well, we have one. But to use Dr. Tom Cowan's joke, which I've happily stolen, and I told him I stole it when I met him, he says the PCR is like finding half a hoof print and claiming you have the whole unicorn. And no one has the unicorn or has ever seen the unicorn. They're claiming that the half of a hoof print is evidence of something that is not known to exist. Look, the problem with the quarter metaphor, the bank robber, is that there are quarters in your pocket and in the bank, and there are bank robbers. We are further from that. No one has ever isolated this virus. What they claim is viral isolation is hocus pocus based on this hocus pocus test, this assay. Test is the wrong word. It's not a diagnostic test. So they are using their hocus pocus and saying, look, we found some of this stuff that doesn't exist in nature. It only exists on our computer model. That means we found some. It's a tautology. It's like saying it is because it is because it is because it is. There's no comparison. There's no contrast. There's no verification. And to conclude this portion of the discussion and bid you good night and wondering if you're going to have the patience to listen to any of this, and I would encourage you to give it a shot, is the astounding failure by the New York Times to admit what it has said in print, which is that this quote-unquote test can get up to 90% false, quote, positives. There are no positives possible. But the New York Times says that it can get up to 90%, and if you go all the way back, like Spencer did, and find this thing in 2007, reporting on a 2006 incident, it can get 100% false positives. Is it any wonder why? It's not meant to diagnose anything. They don't have accurate pictures of samples of the thing they're looking for. Anybody could be the suspect. Like, just round them up. In an article that I linked to, I cover that and some of that in Thursday night's edition. You'll see it's in bold right before the after the players. I present this in writing. I could rewrite it and tighten it up a little bit, but there you have it. It's basically saying what's going on. And I have covered other problems, including the lack of purified isolate in the previous article called "How Safe Is Too Safe." I will tell you that while this investigation has some fans, I am making people angry by reporting this stuff. And if you support this work, please, please, if you can, make a contribution to Chiron Return or get a Planet Waves Core membership. I am taking a risk in doing this. I am taking a risk knowingly. I'm taking a risk willingly. And I am taking a risk because it is the only thing to do is to tell you what I have learned. I take none of this lightly. There is no way that I have less than 1,500 hours into this issue. I'm going to guess that my colleague, Cindy Ragusa, has 3,000 hours. She's easily doing twice or three times the amount of reading that I am doing. And she is an obsessive, thorough reader. I am in love with her mind. And so grateful to have her to work with. In addition, Abby Rohr, Robin Dan, and a number of other people on what is called the XYZ list are obsessively searching the internet for all developments. We are on this. And so I say none of this lightly. And I say all of it, number one, having spent considerable time discussing the issues with two journalists who've led the way on the PCR, having read many other things, deconstructing it in this fashion, on top of a 35-year career since age 19, I'm not really that old, but since age 19, of documenting science fraud, which is a thing. In fact, science fraud is such a thing. I'm going to read you, I'm going to end with a quote from the British Medical Journal. And point you to an article that will soon be on Planet Waves called "Drowning in Digital." I conclude "Drowning in Digital" with another astonishing thing that has come out in the course of the week, and there is much more, and I'm not getting into the motives of this right now. I get what's going on. I'm going to link to an article by a video by someone who goes by the Amazing Polly. Right below this program, she gives the background. You got to think, all this patent fraud, all this bald fraud, you testing for a virus that doesn't even exist and then claiming someone's infected by a thing that only exists on a computer, and then terrorizing the population. I assure you that a great many of these hospital check-ins are psychotropic illness. I would never say that had I not read about it in a Department of Homeland Security report on the subject. So by the time DHS has published it, you know, they're warning, it's their internal memo warning the security apparatus of the nation, that when there is fear, people are going to start checking in to hospitals. One attack in Japan, which was very confined, like one subway station, led 5,000 people to check in to hospitals, if I'm calling correctly, throughout Tokyo, based on the fear, where they had symptoms, they developed the symptoms, the respiratory symptoms, the fever, the achiness, the feeling faint, and all this stuff, from nothing but fear. Nothing but fear. Please do not be afraid. Let me conclude with what the British Medical Journal has said. Mm-hmm. Which article? Here it is. It remains possible to educate yourself. This is in the article Drowning in Digital, which I will link to, probably without a graphic. Drowning in Digital. It remains possible to educate yourself or to succumb to a propaganda campaign that the normally staunch and stuffy British Medical Journal, BMJ, described in a recent editorial. Quote, British Medical Journal, not David Icke or Alex Jones or any Rush Limbaugh, BMJ, quote, science is being suppressed for political and financial gain. COVID-19 has unleashed a state of corruption on a grand scale, and it is harmful to public health. Politicians and industry are responsible for this opportunistic embezzlement. So too are scientists and health experts. A pandemic has revealed how the political medical complex can be manipulated in an emergency, a time when it is even more important to safeguard science. The whole thing is incredible, and it is understated. I sent it to my source, who's a former branch chief in the FBI, and he said, wow, that's an understatement. And by the way, I ran the Johns Hopkins stuff, denied though it may be. This statistical analysis passed. Someone who is a confidential source, who is an actuary, age 84. Actuaries are experts in death statistics. And this guy was vice president for actuaries at a major insurance company. When I met him around 1980, I was a young guy running around an insurance conference with my mom, who was then a life insurance representative, salesperson. And I tracked down this person earlier this year and said, I need to talk to you. And I sent him this Johns Hopkins stuff, and he wrote back to me and said, you're on it, write a book. I will leave you on that note, and on the note of silencio. You are now invited to click on the second player. It lasts as long as this recording did. It's about an hour and 50 minutes. Take it in parts if you need to. Jump around a little bit if you need to. I'll say that it starts a little bit slowly. You know, Kevin Corbett is a Brit, right? He doesn't want to, like, leap in and start saying things out loud. I'm a little more excited than he is. And then, you know, he's a bit long-winded when he speaks. I talk over him a few times. I don't usually do that to my guests. But I had, you know, direct the conversation for you, or so I think, as the host. But in the end, it is incredible. And he gets into the nature of the fraud. And remember that this is a person who first spent his first career working as a specialist nurse for people with AIDS, right? This is a guy working in hospitals in London, taking care of people dying of AIDS. And then he does a doctoral dissertation on the AIDS tests. He figures out what's going on. And his role was essentially, he's one of the authors who was, in a sense, a reviewer and a verifier. But a reviewer and verifier on the level to earn him the 21st of 22 co-authorships. And he has shared with us an hour and 50 minutes of his precious time to help us understand what is going on. All right, I will end with my personal favorite, piece by Silencio, a piece that I love to play in the car while driving at night, and it is called Night Drive. Thanks for listening. It's awesome to be back with you. I got the show done. All right. And I miss my friend Anatoly already. Lots of love. And bye for now.